once more onto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Saturday, July 12th. And if this is also Saturday, July 12th of the year 2014, where you are, you can call in here live and in living color, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. At the end of last hour, we had a question that we didn't really get to.
Which is, does the federal government have a balance sheet? I mean, actually, two questions of this for the rest of you weren't listening. We have...
what's the size of the economy and does the federal government...
What is our net worth?
Right. The net worth of the United States as a whole.
Yes, it's around half a gagillion dollars.
It's a lot.
It's about half a quadrillion dollar bunch.
When we do these figures,
and I think that's a low number, by the way, half a quadrillion.
It is very, very difficult to do the figures, and I have to explain this carefully.
It's because of all the zeros, counting the zeros.
Yes, counting the zeros takes a long time. But really, what it is, anytime you have a value for anything. Unless that's the value that you received in your hand on sale or the value that you paid for it, that's the only time that that value is actually accurate. If you have a valuation on your house and you haven't sold it yet, the likelihood of getting that exact valuation is pretty small. There's transaction costs. There's all kinds of things that go in there. So putting a dollar value on the thing that makes the dollars...
Yeah, that's the thing I was going to point out.
There's a problem there. There's a very real problem there.
Where the federal government has a balance sheet, if you were to add up all the stuff it has minus all the debt it has, and the end result is a positive. And the reason the end result is a positive, and the size of that number depends on how you want to calculate it. Because the single largest asset the federal government has is its ability to tax the economy. And if you were to take all of future potential taxation that the federal government could impose on the United States economy, the number would be so staggeringly large that it would probably frizzle your brain if you were to figure it up.
Right. Now, when we have a GDP, this is a number that we, you know, the economists have put together, and they look at things and
it stands for a really nasty
gross domestic product,
right.
They basically look at, all right, what is the profit to everyone in the United States? And then even though they call it gross,
it's
they
really
still
net, yeah.
Net out a lot of stuff, and they put other things in, and they adjust, and all kinds of... Anytime we're dealing with these numbers, they're all estimates anyway.
I think NDP is already taken by something, so they had to use GDP.
National domestic product or non...
Net domestic product.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a... why would
because
you call
it? Because it really is a net, because the point is, profits are net. They're not gross.
Right.
So why do we call it the gross? And then after we take what was supposedly, which is the net profits of all the companies in the United States, and we say, okay, that's and what people make
as far as income.
As far as income. And basically, they call it the gross. It's really the net at the beginning. And then they subtract stuff from it.
Right.
So really is a net.
It's a really...
You subtract inflation and you subtract any trade deficits that we have.
Exactly.
It's a really strange number. That, like all everything else to do with money, is something that's not real, but we all agree on how it's going to be unreal, and we're really happy with it.
Right. So when you're asking for a straight answer and you're asking an economist...
But on the other hand...
be prepared for a lot of caveats and so on. And it goes back to there's something that we really don't understand as humanity in as a whole. We don't understand it. We want to be able to say this is worth fill in the blank, and we want to use a common denominator or denomination of dollar, and we say, all right, what is the U.S. economy as a whole worth? The problem is that the U.S. economy as a whole is what produces the thing that we would value it with.
Yeah.
So it's like a circular equation. You can't really get one without the other. It's the chicken and the egg and so on. It, basically,
well, you have to throw the farmer in there, too.
There's a farmer involved, and
everything comes in threes.
And some pigs are more equal than others. That's
some
important.
Animals are more equal than
right.
others.
Right. So,
and it's the pigs who are more equal.
The pigs are more equal
right.
than others. Yes. Anyway, that concept goes all the way through our economy. If the only way to truly value the American economy would be to do it in someone else's currency.
And but since, there's not enough of anyone else's
right.
currency to,
so
to do it.
And seeing as, because we live in the United States, we wouldn't understand the relationship of that currency to our own very well.
Well, the other thing is, you really can't value the net worth of the United States or the United States government in anyone else's currency.
Because the currency wouldn't be worth anything without the United States.
But it's not just that. If we looked at the balance sheet, the net worth of the federal government of the United States,
right.
Now, hang on to your hats, folks.
Yeah.
There's literally
just the government. Just the
there
government.
Is no other currency in the world that has enough currency to equal the amount our federal government is worth.
Right. If you look at just
so you couldn't honestly say it's worth this many rubles because there aren't that many rubles.
If you look at the real estate owned by the federal government, if you look at the equipment owned by the federal government, you just keep going down the line, the ability to make income based on tax revenue, the value of the government, this is part of the reason why you can't really have a balance sheet here. You can have a balance sheet for a state inside the federal government because the state can, as a whole, say, and even that, with the state of Texas, which as a percentage of the state owns the least amount of property of any state. And that's because in Texas we believe that private ownership is really important. But even so, if we took that and gave it a value based on today's market conditions, that's really nice. And you could say there's the balance sheet. Well, here's the problem. If the state ever decided to sell all that stuff, the value of it would drop because it's selling all that stuff. So anytime you say there's a value of something, and it's a huge, if you're trying to value all of the oranges or all of the cars or anything else, it's a imaginary figure. As soon as somebody tried to get that value for it, it wouldn't be worth it. It wouldn't be worth the value that you just said. Again, it's that circular logic. If everyone decided to sell their house at the same time, every house would be worthless because nobody would be buying. By definition, everybody selling means that they're selling. So everything was worth nothing.
Nobody to buy.
Right.
Now, to change subjects violently.
Yes, let's do it. Whiplash.
I don't often. Yeah, I do occasionally, yes. But anyway, I'm going to do an I told you so. Everybody who out there who is a Republican, who in the more serious conservative Republican you are, listen carefully.
Oh, boy. Whenever you start this with a political charge, statement, I'm going to get flak jacket on here I'm going to go hide in a corner.
You can get your flak jacket on, but this is the truth. When President Obama was elected, now recognize I'm not a Democrat. And I have been...
are a Republican. Yeah.
I've had Republican stamped on my card for so many years, it's part of the card. But here's the point. I made a statement that got a lot of telephone calls. The statement was, from the perspective of a stock market investor, and my clients are the majority of their money, without exception, is in the domestic U.S. stock market. From the perspective of our clients and perspective of our firm, the election of President Obama was a wonderful thing. And the reason it's a wonderful thing, and I said this, because Democrats have much better performance during their tenure as president than Republicans do. So now, 2,000 days later, this president has been in office for 2,000 days. It's
wow.
A good time to measure how it's going on, okay? And by the way, for whatever it's worth, the good folks at the Dow Jones Corporation have traditionally done the measurement at 2,000 days. So here we are, 2,000 days. Market Watch carried this on July 12th, whenever that was, of this year. It's today, isn't it? Yeah, okay,
it's
good.
Today.
All right.
Yeah.
And here's the historic issue. At 2,000 days, the average Democrat president, during that time, the market is up, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 132.3% at 2,000 days for the average Democrat president at 2,000 days. The average Republican, it's up 33%. That's a big difference. Now, let's see where George W. Bush at 2,000 days, it was down 8.2%. Nixon, it was down 17%. We talk about a huge bull market, the Reagan bull market. At this point, at 2,000 days, the stock market was up 88.3%. Under President Obama, the stock market has risen 142.1% since his inauguration. Under President Clinton, at the 2,000-day point, the stock market was up 176.6%. Now, I will say that it was a little overvalued under Clinton at that point by in 1998, but that's beside the point. What I'm trying to say is that I told you so.
Well, now that you said that,
okay,
I'm going to bring in all the caveats that you said in your told you so, because this
okay.
will help to unruffle the feathers. I think you were just trying to ruffle feathers right there by saying
no, I'm that. Just trying to say I told you so. Now, I yeah. may not like a lot of President Obama's policy decisions.
Here's the caveat.
He's good for the stock market.
The caveats are that the president doesn't actually cause the stock market to go up or down. The president doesn't actually have all of that big an influence on the economy until probably the seventh or eighth year of their presidency. However,
and we're getting really close
to
that.
Even in some cases they don't even have it then. When we talk about the executive branch, we as a culture, and this has a lot to do with what I was talking about at the beginning of last hour, that consciousness that is us, we tend to give a lot of credit to the person whose face is the face of the president, even though they don't have a whole lot of influence on what's going on. The president has raised taxes, has implemented laws that are being thrown out because, or at least executive actions that are being thrown out by the Supreme Court. You go down the list of things that he's doing. There's not a lot of leadership going on, and yet the stock market's done well under his, I don't quite call it a reign. Well, under George W. Bush
is the term.
Under George W. Bush, he lowered taxes. He caused a lot of money to flow back into the economy and not into the government. And, you know, as an economist, we look at it and we say the government does not multiply money well. When it gets money and it spends the money, $1 is created for every dollar spent. I mean, sometimes it's less. 80 cents is created for every dollar spent. Where the private industry can take a dollar and make $15 out of it because of paying people and then buying things with that money and so on. The exponential effect of money movement happens in the private world. So if you look at the surface of it and you say, all right, all these rules say that lowering taxes, giving the money back to the people improves the economy. That's true. And yet during George W. Bush's administration, if you don't want to use the word reign, the economy slumped at the end and slumped at the beginning. And during Obama's administration or reign, the economy has stumbled along, and yet the stock market has done very well, and we've got this recovery going on.
Oh, by the way.
All of this is caveats to say that even though they get the credit or the blame, they're not the ones responsible. So while we say, told you so, you said it, told you so, it's really, it has a lot more to do with the attitude of the nation. And right now, under Barack Obama, for some reason, the attitude of the nation is that we don't expect harsh punishment for doing certain things, so we tend to get a little bit over the top.
It also helps tremendously when the president is in one party and another party can block all actions in Congress.
Correct, and that's actually the biggest caveat of all, in that when the president's powers are limited by another branch, that's when the stock market does the best. So there's another I told you so.
Yeah, well, it's one of those little interesting things. You know, we had two things that are going on. One, the deficit is down to 2.8% of gross domestic product, which is quite good, and is one of the lowest deficits, by the way, in the developed world, if not the lowest right now. Now, there's bad news, too. If in this deadlock in Congress, and whoever's the next president is going to have to start dealing with some of this bad news, and the bad news is that beginning in 2016, we'll first start to see it in 2016, according to the Congressional Budget Office, those forecasts for out of control deficit spending to cover retirees in the United States.
So 2016 is what you're saying.
We'll begin to see.
That's decades away. Don't have to worry about two years. 2 years away. A year and a half away.
We're going to begin to see if the laws stay exactly as they are today, and with Congress this divided, it's entirely possible it will. Then we will see in 2016 the beginning of a slow motion train wreck that will potentially do a lot of damage in the United States. We have a choice. Folks, I know this is going to be everybody considers what I'm about to say unpopular.
There's not a side of the aisle that thinks that this is a great idea. But
we have a choice. We can either cut retirement benefits or we can raise taxes to pay for them.
Oh, we can keep borrowing. We could borrow and borrow and borrow.
Well, the point is, comes a point of diminishing returns on borrowing, because if you look at the way this thing swells out of control between 2016 and about 2030, it's questionable whether there will be enough money in the world
right.
for us to borrow. And the other thing is, interest rates are very likely to be rising during that period, so each successive borrowing will cost us more in interest rates. And this is since the benefits, the entitlements for retirees, and believe me, that's where it is. It isn't for, quote, welfare. Yeah, we're spending some money on welfare, but it is really a tiny little drop in a 5-gallon bucket compared with the expenses that we're going to face for retirees, and that includes veterans, by the way, and it is just a staggeringly huge number that, frankly, is not going to work. We've got a choice. We can either cut the benefits some and raise taxes some. We can cut benefits to the bone, which is not going to happen. There's entirely too many old people who vote. Or we can raise taxes a bunch, which would, again, hurt the economy because we would go past the Laffer point. Or the only feasible solution to the retirement funding crisis at the federal government level is to have a compromise where we raise taxes some and we cut benefits some. Cutting benefits some is something the Democrats as a party are beating the drum against and will not stand for one inch of movement. Raising taxes some is what the Republicans are beating the drum and will not budge an inch. And this is a case where being pure, being absolute, means we're headed for a brick wall. Now, what we're going to do about it, Lord, I ain't smart enough to know. There is a good solution, but apparently Congress is against that too.
They're against a lot of things.
Let a lot of people come across the border and go to work legally
and
get
taxes.
Them to pay taxes. Yes, that would work really well.
I mean, there's quite a few things that could be done to Social Security in the near future that could make it work very well. the less palatable area, the places where it's the most painful, is when you're talking about Medicare, but also the silent elephant, maybe gorilla, that's sitting, maybe it's a gorilla elephant that's sitting in the room, and that's the prescription drug care benefit.
A gorillaphant?
A gorillaphant.
Yeah, that's unfunded, by the way.
There is nothing to fund that. We don't have part of the tax set up. There's not a payroll tax that funds that prescription drug care benefit.
You know, part of that bill that passed.
Which bill that passed?
The drug care benefit, the drug benefit bill.
Right.
Forbids the government, as in Medicaid,
right.
Medicare rather,
right.
From negotiating prices with the drug companies.
Yeah. So basically what we have...
drug companies can charge whatever they want to.
What we have here is a series of mandates on the budget that are difficult to touch, because if you're a congressman or a congresswoman and you go to
it's
the floor...
congressperson.
If you are a congressional body personage of some sort and you go to the floor and you start talking and you say, let's remove this benefit, the reason why they're called entitlements isn't because they're handouts. It's because people feel like they've earned them, that they are entitled to them.
Well, there's actually a title in a law. That's why they're called entitlements.
Right. They feel entitled. They have a contract with the government. If you've been getting a statement for every year for your entire working career saying, this is how much you've made every year and you've been paying taxes into Social Security and this is how much you're going to get, that's a contract. If you're a military retiree, you spent at least 20 years and maybe a lot of blood earning something. For Congress to say we can't afford it is exactly what happened with General Motors when they were talking to the unions. When General Motors was saying, we can't afford this, we've got to do something, and the union said, well, you promised me, and I've got a contract, and it's in writing right here that you said it would happen. And General Motors went bankrupt because they promised in good faith, and they recognized that good faith was in peril. Well, when the good faith of the United States government is in peril, we've got to make some tough decisions. And by tough decisions, I mean not easy. I don't want to see retirees of the federal government. I don't want to see retirees of the U.S. military that fought and bled for us get less than what they were promised. I don't want to see people that have been putting into Social Security their whole lives get paid nothing. But in order for our country to remain solvent, we have to means test Social Security. We have to say if you have another source of income, then you need to not get Social Security. We need to look at retirees of the U.S. military and treat it more like the National Guard retirement program, where you have to wait to a certain age to start receiving it. Now, maybe that can grow with time, but if you've got another income... I realize this is not palatable. It's not something that I'm jumping up and down and saying, yeah, we get to take money from people. I think that's pretty harsh.
Well, we got
but
a choice.
There's only so much money.
We have a choice. We can either raise taxes or we can cut benefits. And if we raise taxes to kind of like the taxes they have in Germany,
our revenues will go down.
Yeah, we could raise.
We'll make less money by raising taxes.
We could raise taxes to 40% or something like that.
And we'll make less money.
Yeah, but I'm just saying we have a choice. And folks, for those of you who want to cut taxes and keep the benefits the same, I want you to think about that just a little bit. Now, there's another thing going on in Congress I want to talk about.
There's more than one thing going on in Congress at once?
Yeah.
No wonder they're confused. Don't allow any gum to be chewed at the process or we'll have heads exploding everywhere.
There is a move that if you are in communication with your congressman, presuming that's John Carter or whoever, there is a really scary, the House Financial Services Committee, and they're going to hold a hearing on Thursday, and the name of it is Legislation to Reform the Federal Reserve on its 100-year anniversary.
Okay.
And what they want, what the Republicans in the House have as an agenda piece is scary. They want to set, by law, a rule that states a formula by which the Federal Reserve will set interest rates.
Ooh.
And take it out of the hands of people and set a fixed rule based on productivity, GDP. There's a whole series of, in other words, there's this formula that goes in. And what Congress wants to do is set a law that takes the ability to control interest rates and thereby the money supply in the United States out of the hands of the Federal Reserve completely and turn it over to a formula so that if we have another emergency where suddenly we have banks collapsing and the money supply collapsing, the Federal Reserve will have to wait 6 months or a year before they can do anything about it. And
let me give a scenario that if you have a formula that's running things, it's, in essence, there's a computer program that is making all the decisions. Think for just a moment about our wonderful smartphones. Would you like your smartphone to respond with a formula to your emails from your boss, for instance? Probably not. Would you like your smartphone to respond with a formula when a bill is due that it will just automatically pay it? Probably not. You might want to look at the bill before you pay it. There's a lot of things that the computers aren't quite good enough to know when we're talking about our personal income. Now, magnify that by the complexity of the entire economy and put together a simple algorithm that will take control, no people involved. I think people can understand just from that scenario the scariness of what we're talking about. We don't have the technology yet.
And even if we had the technology, a fixed formula just simply doesn't work. And let me give you where this is in history. In 1907, we had a banking collapse, not unlike the one we had in 2008. And J.P. Morgan and the president, who was Teddy Roosevelt, acted together, did some unusual things that were certainly not within, not authorized by Congress, because Congress was in recess at the time, and saved the economy from collapse. And there's a real good book on that called The Panic of 1907. It's really an excellent book, because if you know anything about the panic of 2008, the banking panic of 2008, you'll realize it's the same story.
Wait, what century was that, 2008? Let's see.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. I don't remember back that far.
So the issue is, as a result of that panic and the fact that the president and J.P. Morgan had to act outside of the law, not against the law, but outside of the law, the Federal Reserve was formed to have an independent body who could make these decisions and rescue the system if it started to collapse. Congress imposed some laws after that time and into the 1920s that forbade the president from taking those extra legal actions that President Teddy Roosevelt took to rescue the economy in a banking collapse. And so when we had a banking collapse in 1929, the president was unable to step in and rescue the economy. Now, the TARP bill that gave the president a bunch of money that he could step in and rescue the economy with in 2008, they gave it to George W. Bush, enabled him to go in and do the same thing that Teddy Roosevelt did. It's fascinating to me to watch, and by the way, it came out of the House, and it was the Republicans who did it in following the panic of 1907, doing it again, trying to keep the president from being in a position to rescue the economy.
And then in 1933, they fixed it so that the Federal Open
right.
Market Committee was back involved. Mm-hmm. That was 1933, after the collapse in 1929, where
right.
they said there were not enough people involved to make sure that this didn't happen.
And basically what happened is, after the election that threw the Republicans out of office, the Democrats gave the flexibility back again to the Federal Reserve. Taking that flexibility away from the Federal Reserve, in my opinion, will be seen in history books 20 years from now, 30 years from now, as the first steps towards setting up a rigid system that will guarantee another Great Depression. So if you have the opportunity to contact Congressman Carter and tell him to vote against imposing a formula on the Federal Reserve, forcing them to act according to a formula rather than to try to fix things based on the judgment that they have at the time, please do so. Now, if you're one of those people that thinks we ought to do away, if you're like Rand Paul and you think we ought to do away with the Federal Reserve and go on the gold standard, fine. I just want you to take a look at the fact that the price of gold has dropped about 20%.
More than that.
In the last couple of years, and 20, 30%. This is the point. That means the value of your dollar would have dropped that much if we were on the gold standard. You would have a dollar. We talk about inflation. We would have, if we were on the gold standard for the last couple of years,
oh, yeah.
We would have had 30% inflation in 2 years.
Followed by a 25% deflation.
Well, that was before that. First, we had massive deflation, and then we'd have massive inflation, and the Russians and South Africans would have control of the value of the dollar because they have the gold.
Right.
And I cannot, in my wildest dreams, imagine why somebody would want to go on the gold standard. When you look at the gold in the ground, which can be dug out, the majority of it is in South Africa and Russia.
And that's not even counting asteroids as they're flying by, which we may have.
You're counting asteroids?
I
count sheep.
Quite possibly in the next 20 or 30 years, going up and mining the gold. And there are asteroids out there that are significant quantities of gold in one asteroid.
So the point that I'm trying to make is that this issue of getting rid of the Federal Reserve or throttling back the Federal Reserve or forcing them to function within a formula has been tried twice before.
Hasn't been successful
in
yet.
Both occasions, it resulted in Great Depressions. In 1837, the President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, who was a Democrat, destroyed the equivalent of the Federal Reserve. It was the second bank of the United States under a guy named, I think it was Andrew Biddle? No. Yeah.
Yeah, Biddle.
They're both Andrews.
Yeah.
And took its money out of it and gave it away to some banks to get it into the free enterprise system, had runaway inflation, issued what's called the specie circular, where you stop taking paper money, and put us into arguably the worst depression in the history of the country and very arguably the cause of the Civil War. The second time we tried that was in the 1920s, where the Federal Reserve was throttled back, restricted, and forbidden to do anything of any significance, and so was the president. And we had this little event in 1929 through 34, that we, if you may recall, it's called the Great Depression. I really don't think it's a good idea to repeat that, although I think there's some people in Congress who think it might be in their best interest to do so. But we have commercials to play.
Yes, we do. We're speaking of making money.
So we're going to play these commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it's certainly entertaining listening to the commercials. We were trying to figure out if the NutriBullet meant you had to shoot yourself. Anyway,
hopefully not.
773-1400. We have a telephone caller on the line, and you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Before you get to your new topic for this segment, just to hark back for a moment to the means testing for Social Security.
Yep.
Other sources of income would influence as to how much you would receive or be cut, however you want to look at it.
Right.
How would a retired person drawing Social Security but still working a full-time job, would that be considered another source of income and put his Social Security?
This isn't something that's been proposed besides from us, and it's one of the many things. If you look at how you get Social Security when you retire early, they, for every dollar that you make external to the Social Security, you get two-thirds of a dollar less from Social Security. And I think that would probably be the easiest way to get it passed, in that the Congress already has the rules there. So
it all depends when you say working. My, at least the articles I've read on it by economists who said this would be a way to fix it relatively painlessly, it would be for, it would be the magic numbers of like $250,000, $200,000 type thing. If you make more than a pretty high amount of money, and I think it would be there have been some discussion of at the $100,000 level, start restricting. If you've hit the full retirement age, which is roughly 66 now going to 67, and you're still employed and you're making, now you don't have to start taking Social Security at that point, but you can. But the point is that if you started taking your Social Security at that point, it would become the gains in it, or rather the Social Security would start getting cut at around $100,000. So it's not like somebody who was working to make ends meet.
That's if we start it now.
Yeah.
If we wait another 5 or 6 years, it's going to be basically any money you make.
What the problem with these solutions is, they work reasonably well if we start them. If we'd started them 5 years ago, they can be made to work today.
It's more painful to do.
Very frankly, if we wait until, for example, the next presidential election, before we take any action on this, it is going to be substantially more painful. If you'll recall back when there was discussion about restricting Social Security payments, it was going to be only for those people over 55. Well, the problem is that was over 5 years ago.
Now we're talking about only for people over the age of 60.
And since it's been blocked, now we're talking about, and eventually when it hits the point, we generally don't work real well until we get to a crisis, and I would really rather...
Yeah, this is one I'd rather not take to a crisis. Let's do it before it gets to that point.
It'd be really nice if we could avoid cutting payments to people who are already receiving them, but very frankly, with the gridlock in Congress right now...
Probably not going to happen.
I don't see us fixing it until into the next presidency.
Yeah, and this is...
All right, thank you.
Yeah,
right.
Thanks for the call. This is one of... In my... career, I've actually seen one set of evidence where we as a country got together to prevent a crisis, well, I guess two, to prevent a crisis before it happened. And that's...
Is it like right after World War II?
No, in my career.
Oh, okay.
Y2K. There was a bug out there.
Yeah.
A computer bug.
Yeah.
And a lot of people spent a lot of money to prevent it from happening. And then after the fact, people said...
We just wasted the money.
Look, we wasted all that money because nothing happened.
That's like saying...
It's like I didn't need my seatbelt because I was in that car accident and I didn't die. Well, you had your seatbelt on. Well, yeah, but I didn't die.
Yeah. Well...
Yeah. So, and the other thing is the... what is it? The fluorocarbons, the HFCs, the hydrofluorocarbons.
Fluorocarbons.
CHFCs. CHFCs.
Which is also a financial designation.
Right. There was a hole in the ozone layer that was very, very clearly being caused by certain chemicals that we were spraying into it. And the hole closed up into the small hole that's supposed to be there. We did that as a whole because there
as
was...
a hole?
As a whole. The whole did that as a whole, too.
Yes.
But
worldwide, we restricted the use of chlorofluorocarbons.
Right. And there was a very clear link between the two things. This isn't like the debate over what's causing global warming or any of that. This is something that's very clear.
We also decided to cut DDT use.
Right. And when we look back on that, there are a lot of people that the CHFCs are like, well, look, we did that, but we should still be able to use it because, look, there's... No, the hole isn't, they're really small now. Well, they're small now because we stopped it. We also, I mean, there's quite a few things that got to crisis level. When rivers are lighting on fire, we should probably get some clean water going. When there's acid rain falling on our forest killing them, we should probably stop the pollution. Those are crisis level events. If we wait for a crisis level event for Social Security, then we're in trouble. If we wait for a crisis-level event on Medicare, then we're pretty well, it's past the point of solving. If we wait for a crisis level event on Medicare, we're talking about a lot of damage already done.
We got some more commercials to play. We're going to play the commercials, and I got a couple of things I want to hit on the way out when we come back. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello. My proposal for changing Social Security is that a person can only draw out three times what they paid into Social Security. We could set that up.
You have to know exactly how long they're going to live. Are you going to wait till they're like 85 years old and say, oh, you're out of money, bye?
You're going to take it away.
How are you going to figure if you don't know how long people are going to live?
I admire the solution.
How would you be able to say three times? If they start drawing the money and they hit the three times, would you stop them?
What if they're 97 years old?
You just stop them and they starve.
Yes, and
I don't think it's going to work.
I don't say they starve, but...
Well, what's the alternative?
The alternative is they need to take care of themselves otherwise.
Yeah, but if they haven't.
This is the part of the reason. This is important here, because I'm admiring part of what you're saying. Social Security was originally developed to keep the elderly people of the United States from starving. And then Johnson took it and said, hey, it's a retirement for everyone. It's not going to work as a retirement for everyone.
Johnson in Congress.
But I don't think it's palatable for anybody that's out there today to say it's okay to let 97-year-old people starve to death either. So we've got to find that middle ground. And anytime...
We could just kill them.
Oh, there you go.
I don't think that would work either.
I understand that the ice shelf is going to be falling off into the water, and there's a whole series of cultures that just put them on icebergs and let them float away.
And
I don't think that's a good solution.
I hear what you're saying, and I understand the proposal, but we don't know how long people are going to live, so it doesn't work very well. Thanks for calling, though.
One other comment.
Sure.
I'm a meteorologist, and the hole in the ozone layer was at about 100,000 feet above the South Pole.
Yes.
So how does all of the chlorofluorocarbons that were emitted in the northern hemisphere make it to 100,000 feet over the South Pole?
There's actually a pretty good answer for that one, but thanks for calling. Okay?
Yeah, if you want to email us off the air, we can send you some links to that.
The fact is that there's always a hole over the South Pole at least half the year. The problem is that if the ozone layer gets thin enough, that hole gets bigger. And it was the thinning of the ozone layer that was the problem, causing the hole to get bigger. And as it got thicker, the hole closes up again. Anyway, I wanted to hit a couple of things before we got out of here. And one of them I just really quickly mentioned, the percentage of health uninsured people in the United States is the lowest since we've been tracking. It's now down to about 11%. It was 13.8% last year, and it was up to 18% a few years ago. This is really good news for the cost for the things we were talking about, because it has a tendency to reduce costs down the road because we're getting preventive care. Another thing, Standard & Poor's downgraded Puerto Rico again. There's a really distinct possibility that Puerto Rico may default on a lot of bonds in the near future. Why is that important to you if you don't own Puerto Rican bonds? A lot of people bought Puerto Rican municipal bonds because they were high interest, and some either a broker or somehow they figured that it's like a state, it won't default. Folks, Detroit has gone down, Puerto Rico's gone down. It's that high interest rate that we were talking about earlier. If something is being offered at a high interest rate, it's risky. And I strongly suspect there's going to be a lot of people who find out, as they have in Detroit and other places, they're going to in Illinois. And they're going to, in Puerto Rico, discover that the price of high interest rates on bonds or annuities or whatever is you take a distinct risk of not getting your money back. So just beware out there of these things going on. The other thing is over on the stock side, we mentioned a few minutes ago, what'd you say? It wasn't really Cynic. It's what?
Cynk, C-Y-N-K.
Well, it's still, C-Y-N-K looked like Cynic to me.
Yeah, well, either way, it is sunk.
And the point is that it's a penny stock that was at 6 cents. It was up at $14.71, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of investors who bought that stock and now can't sell it.
Yeah, because it was being manipulated.
And the point is, it never was anything. And I think a lot of people, greed and fear and are the two things that drive the market, and we're moving into the greed side from the fear side slowly now.
The people, this is the other side of things. And you said it just now, but I'm going to say it in a slightly different way. If someone comes to you and has the secret to wealth, they have the thing that nobody's been telling the common man, that all the rich people know this secret, and if you know the secret, you can get rich too, it's probably a scam. Because if you actually look at these
it's not probably a scam.
It is a scam. If you look at these very, very wealthy people, most of them got there with hard work and some semblance of luck. It's going to require the same thing from you. It's going to require a lot of hard work and some semblance of luck. This is what happens. Mm-hmm. That's what the American dream is based on. There isn't a secret. It's hard work and luck. It's like dieting. It's exercise and lower calorie diets to make you lose weight.
Factually, if you start off fairly early in life and you invest a reasonable percentage of your income in the United States economy, not in the government, not in bonds, in the economy, and you're willing to ride that roller coaster for 30 or 40 years, you're probably going to be wealthy. I mean, I can't think of there's no situation I can imagine that I've seen in history where you weren't wealthy.
Right, and if you make the decisions for your life based on that, you're going to continue to get better jobs because you're planning ahead, and that's something we've seen. You know, mentioned this yesterday to a client. Some of Old Baldy across from me's clients started with $50 a month or $25 a month. And are now multi millionaires, and they didn't get to be multi millionaires.
I wouldn't say multi. They're millionaires, though.
They didn't get to be millionaires by $25 a month. That discipline got them there. They kept raising it every time they got a raise at work. They kept going, and they kept getting better jobs because they're planning ahead. And that's part of the attitude that goes with success. That's the secret, if there is one. You plan ahead.
And we're almost out of time. I have one last thing to throw out there. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen interest rates fall again. People are putting money back into bonds again. Folks, this is a head fake. Interest rates are going to rise. The consensus of professional bond traders, and they tend to be pretty right.
You have a second Baldy full agreement here.
And is that by 2017... the Fed rate, which is now effectively zero, will be 3.5%. So if you take, you run that out to the 10-year Treasury, which is 2.5%, that means it will be up around 6%, which is its traditional level, by the way. That would result in a 10-year Treasury being bought today being worth probably maybe 60 cents on the dollar. At that point,
if you hold it to maturity, you're going to get 100 cents to 100 cents. But if you don't, you're in trouble.
No, you're not actually going to get anything because inflation is probably going to run as high as that interest rate now and then.
You'll get the dollar, but you'll have some inflation out of it.
Yeah, okay.
If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach us locally at 947-1111 or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Please go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Listen to podcasts and contact us.
News Radio 1400.
When you get the chance. We'll be back next week.
Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.